I mean, it's calling attention to the complicity of universities in the occupation. The other thing that the academic boycott is calling attention to is the fact that Palestinian universities are under occupation, that professors can't get permits, that American professors can't get permits to go work in a Palestinian university. I mean, there's a huge amount of repression and lack of being heard going on in Palestinian academic settings that we're completely oblivious to. I think it's really something we need to take seriously.
That was Alice Rothschild discussing her documentary film about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict titled Voices Across the Divide. For more information about the film and related issues, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In an investigative piece titled The Wolf of Sesame Street, Revealing the Secret Corruption Inside PBS's News Division, published on the news website Pando Daily, journalist David Sirota wrote about a public broadcasting service news series titled The Pension Peril, which advocated cuts to public employee pension benefits. The Pension Peril series, scheduled to be broadcast by PBS stations across the country over the course of 2 years, Sirota reveals, was secretly funded by former Enron company trader and billionaire John Arnold. Arnold, who had donated $3.5 million to PBS for the production of the Pension Peril series, is a passionate and longtime critic of public employee pensions. As Sirota reports, through his foundation, Arnold has made large contributions to politicians, political action committees, and think tanks to advance his campaign to slash public employee retirement benefits. Disturbingly, the PBS series presented views critical of pension funds very similar to that of its funder, without revealing to the audience the source of its financial support. However, just 2 days after Sirota's investigative piece was published on February 12th, an embarrassed PBS management announced it would return the $3.5 million provided by John Arnold. Your reporter spoke with Jeff Cohen, founder of the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who now serves as the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. Here he discusses the obvious conflicts of interest and ethical violations that occur when media outlets allow their funders to influence the content and political spin of their journalism.
The funder of this, to the tune for $3.5 million, former Enron trader, hedge fund manager named John Arnold. John Arnold has gone all over the country funding political efforts, ballot initiatives, think tanks, advocacy groups that push toward the cutting of public workers' pensions. He's a monomaniac about it. Everyone in the world knows it. The great journalist Matt Taibbi referred to this guy, John Arnold, as the next generation's Koch brothers. You know, there are many ways that you could balance state budgets. You could cut corporate subsidies. You could bring down the prison industrial complex, you could raise taxes on the wealthy. But John Arnold and others have the ability to twist the debate so the only idea that gets prominence in how to balance state budgets is cut the public workers' pensions. So John Arnold is famous for underwriting a whole social movement around that cause. And then public TV starts running a series of news segments called The Pension Peril, and John Arnold has funded it for $3.5 million. The money was ultimately returned, and the series has been put on hiatus because David Sirota exposed it, and it became a controversy. But I would argue that the funding of public affairs news, public affairs programs, documentaries, 8-part, 1-hour series for years, for 15 years or so, on public television, that corporations have underwritten programming that they had no business underwriting, and the results in the programming showed a mistakable corporate bias because the corporations paid for the programming.
Jeff, in theory, is there not supposed to be a firewall between the fundraising arm of a nonprofit media outlet like PBS and the news producers and news directors who make decisions about content?
There's no doubt that public TV has rules, but they've never been abided by. I mean, the rules say not only should an interested funder not be allowed to fund programming, but someone who has the perception of interest, you know, it's not just about the reality of bias. It's even, they're supposed to protect at public television against bad optics. But the reality is there's no longer any optics at all at public TV because the corporations have been underwriting the programming for so many years, you know, no one even sees it anymore. That's the problem. People are blind to it. I could give you example after example. Last year, Nova had a show called The Rise of Drones. One of the funders was Lockheed Martin, a major drone manufacturer. Another show about the food industry. Big funder, Dow Chemical, you know, a GMO corporate food company. About 10 years ago, there was this multi-part series called Commanding Heights on public television, extolling, you know, multinational capitalism. It was so biased that the Wall Street Journal was just raving about how great it was, with an article headlined, PBS likes capitalism more than the commercial networks do. Who funded that? BP, Federal Express, and Enron, until Enron was exposed as a graft operation and the Enron money was returned, but not the money to all the other corporations. You can go on and on and on and on. And it's part of the reason that public television in this country is so timid, is so bland, and will not take on the most powerful forces in our society, who just happen to be large corporations that are their underwriters.
That was Jeff Cohen, founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media and associate professor of journalism at Ithaca College. Find links to David Sirota's investigative piece on PBS and related articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Locus Focus after these messages.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The oil industry has targeted the Pacific Northwest and Northern Rockies as the most direct shipping route to move heavy equipment to tar sands operations in northeastern Alberta. Since 2010, megaloads of enormous mining equipment have rumbled over winding mountain river corridors through Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. One of the first groups to bring attention to the megaloads is Wild Idaho Rising Tide, who's now trying to stop the longest and widest megaload yet. This industrial transport is heading up Highway 95 through Idaho to the Montana Refining Company in Great Falls, Montana, which is processing Canadian bitumen into transportation fuels for United States markets. This morning we talk with Helen Yost, a spokesperson for Wild Idaho Rising Tide, about her organization's campaign against the megaloads and what's happening with these latest shipments. Helen, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you very much.
So let's start by talking about what are megaloads. This is a word that I don't think any of us even had in our vocabulary until a few years ago.
Well, they're typically oversized or over-legal shipments, normally more than 150 feet long, as wide sometimes or wider than two lanes, which is 24 feet, towering up to 30 feet tall, so they can't typically fit under overpasses. And the weights have been, well, these ones that want to come up Highway 95, are going to weigh in at 1.6 million pounds, although some weigh as little as a standard semi-truck.
Well, you used the term extra legal loads, which I guess was the official term for these loads when they were first being proposed to go along Highway 12 through Idaho. And some people had trouble with that because extra legal loads could also refer to wind turbines and other large loads that are way smaller. So what sets these loads apart from what have been traditionally considered extra legal loads?
Well, the very fact that they're going to very destructive mining practices and or refineries that produce tar sands is the main impetus behind our push to stop them from using our public resources and tearing them up pretty well, too, as we are a climate activist group. And other folks in the region, including us, are also opposed to these loads going through wild and scenic river corridors and through the largest complex of wildlands in the lower 48 states in north central Idaho, simply because they diminish wilderness character with their size and their industrial focus.
Well, these loads also seem to be quite a bit bigger than anything we're used to seeing on not just roads like Highway 12 or Highway 93, but even like on the interstate freeways. Is that true?
Yes. Interstate lanes are typically 16 lanes wide, but these would still overhang into two lanes. And so the main safety impediment is that they do block other traffic in both directions, especially on two-lane highways. And you wouldn't be able to miss these. They do move in the night, however, and so a lot of people do, which is unfortunate because they should see what corporations are doing to our roads and to our safety.
Well, actually, I saw some very interesting video that was shot in the winter, this past winter, of the Omega Morgan load, the first load that was going through John Day, Oregon, and I think it went through about midnight. And one of the things that kind of struck me was that there are all these people in the street in downtown John Day, which is about three blocks long, very excitedly watching these mega loads go through. And while I looked at this image and thinking, this is this monstrosity going through a really small town, it seemed like these people were kind of thrilled by the experience. So I guess some people are actually noticing that they're going through. What has been the general response in communities where these loads do go through?
Well, I guess it would depend on the political leanings of the town. People who understand the purpose of these loads are generally opposed to them, as tar sands mining is very destructive of everything it touches, the lands, the air, the water of indigenous people in northern Alberta, as well as the global climate because of their profuse carbon and greenhouse gas emissions. However, in small towns where Americans are typically very awed by large technology or see dollar signs with these loads coming through and the crews that number in the dozens staying in their hotels and restaurants, many times folks will actually welcome these BMS.
Well, I was interested in the situation in John Day because the protesters, there were a lot of protesters there the night the first load went through, this first load of, I guess is the third round of megaloads going to the tar sands now through various routes in the Northwest and Pacific and Northern Rockies. But on the one hand, there were protesters, many of them who came from Eugene, and then there were the locals. And I'm wondering if there's a kind of divide going on between outside agitators and local people, and whether there's a difference of opinion between these two groups about whether these loads should be going through.
I would say that initially folks accept these loads, even in rural areas that tend to be a little more conservative. But as time goes on and they start to see the damages to their roads and bridges and how these corporations more or less take over their roads and therefore infringe on their civil liberties as they're going through, they start to lean in the direction of not welcoming these loads. There's a bunch of folks in eastern Oregon that actually the Nisa City Council banned these big loads from their city streets if they had to take them as an alternative route. If they got banned from Clark Boulevard, which is actually a county road where the state can not permit these loads, however they use that boulevard anyway. So actually,
let's back up a little bit because I was reading your postings about Nisa, which for listeners who don't know where that is, it's way eastern Oregon, right near Ontario, and which is near the Idaho border. But did the loads go through Nisa after the city council had banned the loads?
No, they didn't. They stayed on Clark Boulevard, but that's still also, as I said, questionable use since the state can't legally permit these loads on that road. It's just a county road, so it's not under their jurisdiction. But no, they didn't end up using the Nissa City streets because they weren't diverted off Clark Boulevard.
So let's talk a little bit about what is in these loads. We know that they're very large, and we know they're heading to the tar sands, but what are these mega trucks actually carrying?
Well, it varies. There were 350 loads that came through the Northwest from the ports of Vancouver, Pasco, and Lewiston. And those were components of a first-step processing plant, an upgrader for the Kearl Oil Sands project by ExxonMobil, who's a subsidiary of the subsidiary's name is Imperial Oil of ExxonMobil up in northern Alberta. And so they looked sort of squarish and frame-ish and, had all kinds of tubes and pipes running through them and built 20% of that facility.
And these upgraders are actually, what they're doing is they're taking this bitumen, which is kind of this tarry substance that they're mining in the Athabasca tar sands areas, and then turning it into, I guess they call it syncrude, which is actually oil that can be used to process gasoline and other more conventional things.
Yeah, these facilities separate out the sand and clay and dirt and water from the actual bitumen or the tar sands. And then change it, mix it with other chemicals, turn it into dilbit, which is diluted bitumen, and put it through a pipeline to wherever it's going to actually be refined. So that's what those parts did. But the ones that have been coming through lately are at their largest size, like the one that went through the Nez Perce Reservation and raised all kinds of resistance in August, are full evaporators. And those are used for in situ mining, where they inject steam underground, sort of like fracking through horizontal piping, and then other wells extract that liquefied tar sands up. And then these evaporators actually recycle that returned water out of the ground so that it can be produced again into steam and shot back underground with chemicals. The parts that have been coming across Oregon are the cores of those evaporators, the outer